Dr. Parsons, on Thursday, October 15th and Friday, October 16th, you were invited to speak at the conference Health at the McKenzie Institute at University of Toronto's Victoria College Chapel. I attended the conference as well. The conference was about resilient critical infrastructure and cybersecurity. Please discuss the significance and main purpose of this conference, along with the significance of having today's youth involved in understanding the consequences involved in terrorism, cybersecurity, and in the possibility of an electromagnetic pulse happening.
So the conference was meant to look at the vulnerabilities that exist, let's say, predominantly within Western or at least highly electrified and digitized economies. So that meant that a lot of the speakers, I think all the speakers actually were brought together, had a focus not in Canada or the United States. And so it looked at a variety of different sorts of systems, if you will. So it was looking at the way that people interact with systems, vulnerabilities that are attached there. It was looking at the different kinds of military or paramilitary activities that could be undertaken that would have devastating effects on Western government's ability to provide infrastructure. And then it also, of course, looked at some aspects of immigration and how do you do security clearance and the way that digital networks themselves sort of play in with all of this. The real value is it was trying to provide a very holistic analysis of the kinds of risks that are attached to just the way that we live in Canada, the United States, and by extension, European countries. There were a variety of different kinds of scenarios that were presented. So you mentioned EMP, electromagnetic pulses. There were a series of speakers that talked about how paramilitary or military attack that deliberately attempted to disrupt or destroy or degrade digital systems would have a ripple effect. It could very seriously degrade the ability of Western governments to provide services to their citizens and sort of all of the fallout, if that's happened for a day, a week, a month, a year, or more. And then there were also examples of, what's going on right now. And so there was someone from Canada who was speaking about sort of the power system kinds of attacks that they receive on a daily basis and their defensive mechanisms to try and resist it. There's also discussions from a member of Canada's law enforcement community explaining, this is what we're trying to do to catch up. Here's what here's some of the innovative tactics that we're developing. And then there was some discussion about, how exactly do we approach immigration issues such that we can bring people into this country as we ought to when people are coming from, refugee zones or things like that, but do it in a way that ensures that we're not inviting additional risks into our borders or at least, not excessively introducing new risks into our borders. I would say that probably the overall value in the end to youth and thinking about these issues is, terrorism is an existential threat, and actually going beyond sort of the existential, I don't know what it could be, but it could be something, and getting real data. Here's some of the actual threat scenarios that are seen on a daily basis. I don't think it should serve to further alarm individuals. I think that actually causing fear is antithetical to helping people prepare and think through these things in a rational way. But it does help to give some nuance and context when you have government agents or government agencies or people in the corporate sector or academics are saying, this is a problem or it's not a problem. So it lets people make up their own minds. In terms of cybersecurity, I think that one of the difficulties is that people regard cybersecurity as the equivalent of magic in almost the same witch trials, and that we know that we need to be worried about witches or cybersecurity, but we don't really quite know what to do. And so in that sense, I think that the conference was helpful, that it actually provided examples. Like, here are current existing vulnerabilities that are exploited. And it's not just by governments. I think that's really important. It's not just the NSA. It's not just GCHQ. It's not just the Russians. It's not just the Chinese. But in fact, the tools that really are still, I think, in the land of James Bond. So the ability to track everyone through a network called the SS7 network, as an example, if you have a cell phone. Now, this James Bond sort of concept, it has been a problem, a real-world problem, that's now been commercialized, that exists in the world today. And so I think in that way, it's good because we have gotten to a point with several security issues and surveillance issues that you don't need millions or billions of dollars in the bank to pull it off anymore. You need to find someone, pay them between $100,000 and $200,000, and they can provide you with a pretty robust way of tracking or monitoring people or intruding upon people's privacy. And the people who use that tool do not need to be computer experts. They need to be analysts. So we've seen the real productization of intrusive attacks, and I think that that's probably the most important thing to take away from it. It's why if we keep passing laws or we keep enabling companies to sue security researchers, why we're going to be worse off. These are problems that they weren't discovered yesterday. They've been problems for a long time, but we're getting to a point where if we don't figure out how to fix them soon, maybe by replacing some infrastructure, we could be in, it's not going to undermine our democracies tomorrow or something like that, but it will make our lives more challenging, that's for certain.
And with $100,000 to $200,000, how many people would be trapped?
If you're in the SS7 network, as an example, so this is sort of a back-end network for cellular infrastructure, you could be in Kazakhstan and you could monitor someone in North America because it's a global interoperable network. And it has to be, because that's one of the key ways that mobile communications actually go from one part of the world to another. Some of the work that Citizen Lab has done, which is where I'm doing a postdoctoral fellowship right now, is we've been chasing a bunch of companies around the world, in particular FinFisher and Hacking Team. And, here you see, intrusion malware, things like that, are being sold to really repressive governments. Is one example, a government in Africa purchased this tracking software, and it was used to then target expat journalists in London and in the United States as well. So we're also talking about the ability to purchase a product in your country as a state actor in that case, and then use it to intrude upon the privacy around the world. That's an increasingly common thing, and especially for journalists, for academics who are dealing with sensitive issues, for businesses. Everyone is interested to someone. And it used to be that it was so expensive that no one could do anything. That's changing. It's changing quickly.
As a postdoctoral fellow here at Monk School's Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, you are the managing director of the Telecom Transparency Project, where you investigate the practices, processes, rationales, and politics of third-party access to telecommunications data. Where do you see the future of Monk School Citizen Lab?
Ooh, future of the lab. onward and upward. So the work that I'm doing, in particular at the Citizen Lab, focuses on how telecommunications companies and their data is accessed. So my work going forward will continue to try and understand the kinds of data that are being collected by telecommunications companies, who gains access to that information, either in transit or after it's been collected by telcos. And so I've been spending a lot of time focusing on what are called transparency reports. So transparency reports just identify the regularity at which state actors come to companies and say, hey, we want data on your customers. The rationale for that is, in the Canadian context, is we have very bad reporting at the federal level, and the provincial level, and municipal level, about what kinds of data authorities are collecting. And so going to the companies is one barrel of two-barrel shotgun, if you will. The second side being trying to convince government to also be more transparent. The goal ultimately is to have sets of data from both the private world as well as the public world, and then compare. So is it the case that these numbers more or less line up? And if there's huge variations, why? Where are those? And so my work right now focuses on Canada. We're hoping to expand some of this work with international partners, really around the world, to see some of the tactics and the methods that we adopted at the Citizen Lab over the past year and a half, 2 years, can have similar sorts of positive effects. So as one example, because of the work that we were doing along with some other events, many of Canada's largest telecommunications companies now release transparency reports, whereas previously they never did. So it's one small bit, but I think it's an important piece. In terms of the lab writ large, the Citizen Lab is a really dynamic organization. So this isn't typically someone's permanent home. So they will be here for, 4 to 6 years maybe, and then they'll move somewhere else, right? And this has been to our immense benefit, because it means that we have people all over the world in all sorts of different areas. And because we're an academic research lab, sort of the research projects we do will presumably have a similar sort of take. So it'll have something probably to do with network measurement, something probably to do with trying to understand how sensitive people, be they journalists or NGOs or something like that, are targeted by state private actors. But the specifics are more challenging to define. And the reason is because we have people coming in and leaving, because we're an academic place, if someone comes in and has a really cool idea, which we get all the time, then we let them do it. And because we bring in people from all over the world as visiting fellows or staff or things like that, we get this really dynamic workflow. So 5 years from now, it's really going to depend on who is here. I expect we're still going to be doing human rights work. We're still going to be focusing on ICT, because that's what we do. But the specific contours of the research, it's a really good question, one that I think we're all interested to see how it turns out.
Certainly. Dr. Parsons, you also completed a PhD in political science from the Department of Political Science at the University of Victoria, where you completed a dissertation. Please provide our listeners with an overview of your dissertation. In addition, what are some of the political drivers of internet service providers' network surveillance practices, and how does that compare to the practices exercised 10 years ago?
So my dissertation, it was a comparative piece of political science. So I looked at a technology called deep packet inspection in the way it was deployed in Canada, the US, and the UK to understand why it was instantiated in different ways. So why is this technology of any real interest? Historically, the internet routed data, sort of like you would imagine in the past, a postman would. So they look at the addressing information, they send it along to its destination, and they didn't pop open your letters, they didn't read what you were saying, sending because it wasn't their job. Deep packet inspection sort of turns that a bit on its head. So it goes from just trying to get data packets to the destination, sort of looking at addressing information to sniff out the kinds of traffic that you're generating or sending. And it moves to doing what's called full packet analysis or deep packet analysis, which means they get right into the content of what's being sent. And so that can be invasive to different levels. So that can be literally reading what you're typing if it's over non-encrypted communication, to just knowing what application generated what you're sending and so forth. And you can provide different levels of discrimination based on it. You can also modify your communications in real time. So that's a pretty serious effect, and I didn't look at it for what I was doing my dissertation, but you can look at China as an example, is rewriting data packets in real time to modify content.